Welcome to Banfield, everyone. We've got new developments in the Brian Laundrie investigation. Stephen Bertolino, the Laundrie family attorney, has confirmed for us where the Laundries went after Brian's remains were found. You may have seen Chris and Roberta Laundrie carrying small weekend bags, loading up their red pickup truck and driving off from that little yellow house, but not before posting no trespassing signs all over their front lawn. Yesterday, they came back from that short trip, and we now know they went to Orlando, and they took their daughter, Cassie, with them. Also in tow, Cassie's young children. We do not know where they stayed while they were in Orlando or what they did, but we do know they were in Orlando. I'm joined now by News Nation's Brian Enten, who is following in the exact path that Brian Laundrie and Gabby Petito took as they drove their white transport van from Moab to Salt Lake City, Utah, and then on to Grand Teton National Park. That is the focal point of the Gabby Petito investigation, which still to date has yet to officially name her killer. Brian is live with us now. So I can see the stop sign behind you, but Brian, just place me. Where are you in that journey? How far along are you?
So we just pulled off the road here. We're lucky to even be with you because there's almost like no cell service in this area. We had no cell service for almost an hour. We're in Thane, Wyoming. It is right near the Wyoming-Idaho border. We're on our way to Jackson, Wyoming tonight where we'll spend the night. And then tomorrow we're going to go into Grand Teton and go into that area, talk to people there, and then go to the area where Gabby's body was found.
And so as you have been, you know, traveling, you were able to stop in Moab and sort of to your shock and surprise, you were able to speak with the police and not only just speak with them, to go with them to the exact location where Brian and Gabby were pulled over and where that now infamous body cam tape was recorded of their interrogation of both Brian and Gabby separated. So walk me through, first of all, how you got that interview. And then second of all, what it was like being there.
So we started off this journey in Moab, Utah, which you mentioned it. That's where the body camera incident happened. That's where the domestic incident happened. And we have been there for, we were there for about 24 hours, went to all of the critical stops, tried to talk to as many people as we could. We're going to have all of that tomorrow night for you on News Nation. We have to put it all together. But we did get this interview with the assistant police chief in Moab. He hasn't really spoken out up until now because obviously there's been these investigations going on and they are actually investigating the way that their officers handled that traffic stop. You know, there's been a lot of scrutiny there. Did they do the right thing? They now have an outside agency investigating them to see whether it was handled correctly and how they should proceed in terms of new training and whether the officers did the right thing. So there's a lot he can't talk about, but there were some things that he could talk about, and I want you to listen to part of what he told us.
No matter what type of call we're responding to, we're always looking at ways that we can handle them better. And that's really what I think our focus is moving forward right now is just being better. We can't change what happened yesterday, but what we can change is the way that we approach situations moving forward. I'm not saying that one way or another, whether or not I believe anything was done incorrectly or properly on this particular incident. What I'm saying is that even those officers are doing self-evaluation based on that call and what they could do better. That I do know.
So there is so much more to that conversation. You mentioned we went out to where the traffic stop happened. We're going to have all of that for you tomorrow night. I mean, this journey has been crazy. We've been on the road nonstop, so we need time to put it all together. We're going to have the special for you tomorrow night. But that gives you a glimpse into sort of what the assistant chief is saying about all of this in Moab.
Well, I'll tell you what, Brian, as I look at you there in your, you know, very small puffy jacket, I'm just sort of taken by the tale of two parts of this country. You've come from Florida, which was by all means pretty hot and sweltering from the time you started covering the story on the, you know, front lawn of the laundry house, to where you are now, which is really where this story should button up. I mean, I get it. We're still wondering what's going to happen with the Laundrie parents. Nothing is going to happen with Brian because that is over. You can't charge and convict a dead man. But there is still the outstanding story of Gabby, and it is still a mystery. Everybody wants to know what happened and who done it. And it's kind of frustrating to think that's still under wraps because it doesn't seem like it needs to be. As you do this journey, though, are you struck by the dichotomy of coverage in terms of now the story that you're on as opposed to the one you've left behind?
Yeah, absolutely, Ashley. I mean, you know, I've been outside the Laundrie house for 6 weeks in Northport covering that side of it and talking about Moab and talking about Grand Teton and all of these places, wondering what they were like and what it was like for Gabby on this journey, and to actually retrace the exact journey has been really interesting. But I want to go back to what you said at the beginning of the show, because, you know, I still think about everything happening in Northport just because I was there for so long. And it's so interesting that you were able to confirm that they went to Orlando, because my Twitter has been like lighting up when they were gone. People were spotting them in the Orlando area and tweeting us. Someone saw them at Target. And so many said, well, we weren't really sure it was them. So it's so interesting that you were able to confirm that they were actually in Orlando. And the fact that Cassie and her grandkids were there, I also find very, very interesting, because the last we heard from Cassie, you know, there was sort of this drama behind the scenes, this falling out between her and the parents and with her and the lawyer. We heard that she has also spoken to Mr. Bertolino in recent days. So apparently this family is now coming back together, perhaps as they grieve their son.
Sure, sure. And I just want to remind viewers who might be just tuning in that Brian is now retracing the journey that Gabby and Brian took in the white transport van. He's going from Moab to Salt Lake City and then on to Grand Teton, and was able to actually speak, if you're just tuning in, was actually able to speak with the police in Moab, who, you know, are now having to come to terms with that stop, that now infamous body cam stop. And I'm just sort of fascinated by you know, each step along the way, what you're going to be able to find out, given that now, you know, people shouldn't be maybe so buttoned up, since this investigation isn't as dire, given that the what looked like the main target is now dead. So to this end, I also want to debunk something, Brian, with you, if I can. And, you know, forgive me, because I know you're journeying, but I know you also keep tabs on your social media and you keep tabs on the story in Florida. And I'm going to read something from one of our viewers named Lisa. This is what Lisa said. And it's referring to the Laundries leaving before that two-day trip to mourn the loss of Brian and then returning. This is what Lisa said. The Laundries came out with a backpack and 4 to 5 boxes. They didn't have the boxes when they returned. The question Lisa has is, where did they go? Where did the boxes go? So we're actually showing some of the tapes here. And Brian, it's important to debunk that we've gone over all of the tapes and we've gone over older photos as well, which we're showing now. But this photo that you're seeing up on the screen is actually from October 17th, which is, you know, which is 5 days, I think, before they left. So clear that up for Lisa and those on Twitter who seem to feel like there's really a missing piece of this story. Where are those boxes and where did they take them?
So first of all, Ashley, in the video of the Laundries getting into the red truck they left, which we've now learned was to Orlando, in that moment, all Roberta had was a knapsack. And you mentioned the October 17th when boxes were put in the truck. So there's no video or photos of boxes going into the truck immediately before they left for Orlando. But I will tell you this, spending so much time outside the home, I have befriended almost all of the neighbors, and I have colleagues that are still out there. But my main source now is the neighbors, because I know all of them, because I was there for so long. And they are saying that Chris Laundrie did put boxes in the back of the pickup truck earlier that day before they left. It just was not caught on video or in pictures. So there were some kind of boxes loaded into the truck earlier that day.
So that, I mean, I was thinking it was a debunk, but it is not a debunk. There were actually boxes loaded into the truck and not brought back. So who knows whether the boxes stayed in Orlando, whether the boxes were dropped off somewhere along the way. No one knows what was in the boxes, but we do know that when the laundries came back, they sure didn't take any boxes out of the truck. They just had these carry-on sort of weekend bags with them. So it's a very, I mean, listen, our viewers are really astute, Brian. They catch a ton of these details, and if they don't catch them, they zoom out on the pictures and they catch them on the second pass. It's pretty impressive. All right, so the next question I have for you is, obviously, I haven't been able to stop thinking about this notebook that was found in the reserve next to Brian's dry bag, which was what Chris and Roberta miraculously found. Don't even get me started. But, you know, that might hold the keys to everything. We may not have to bother with the FBI. We may not have to bother with the Northport and whatever secrets they're holding on to. The notebook might have it all. What's the status on the darn notebook?
Listen, we try to get info every day, and even though I've been in Wyoming and Idaho and Utah, I'm still trying to get info out of the FBI and Northport Police. And the latest we heard from Northport Police, which I've told you before, is that they believe the notebook is salvageable, that it was wet, but they think it is salvageable and that there is something in it that could help with the investigation. But then they handed it over to the FBI to sort of salvage it and do whatever needs to be done, the process that needs to be done to make sure that they can actually read what's inside it. So we still don't have any information about what's in it, what the note may say, but you're right. I mean, this is critical. If Brian Laundry wrote a letter, perhaps a suicide note, and explained what actually happened, you know, you're right. I mean, that would sort of, you know, give us so much info that we don't have right now.
And I'm counting 6 days. It does not take 6 days to dry out a notebook. So they've had plenty of time to dry the notebook and then crack the notebook and then read the notebook. And I got to say, Brian, I just don't think that anybody in Brian Laundrie's state would bother taking a notebook in such a moment of awfulness for him. Unless he planned to use the notebook. So it seems to me that it is a pretty fair assumption. There's got to be something, some valuable information about this mystery in that book. But 6 days, I mean, that is a long time, Brian.
Yeah, and it's also a long time that the FBI hasn't really said anything. I mean, this really hit me when I was in Moab. Yes, you know, most people are putting the puzzle pieces together and saying that, you know, Brian Laundrie is likely responsible for Gabby Petito's death based on everything that we know. But the FBI hasn't come out and said that. And they're going to likely need to issue some kind of memo, some kind of press release, hold a press conference, and actually say whether they have the evidence from everything that they've looked into and from the autopsy and the DNA that they've collected all along, that it was in fact, based on the evidence they have, Brian Laundrie who killed Gabby Petito. Because when we were in Moab, there are still conspiracy theories floating around. There are still people worried. There's another double murder that happened there to a married couple, two young women, back in August that people are concerned could somehow be connected. So there's going to come a point where the FBI really has to clear this up, at least to put people's minds at ease, especially in places near where we are.
And then just the last nugget before I let you go, because I know you still have a bit of driving ahead of you tonight, even. The man never stops working. You met a lot of very intriguing people, not just protesters, not just looky-loos, but actual tourists who came to your work site in front of the laundry house. Give me the quick, you know, the quick 30 seconds on it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're doing this segment tonight and that you mentioned earlier that these people at home, they're so good at uncovering things in this case. It amazes me every day the things they zero in on. Many of them are these sort of crime tourists, and that's what they call themselves. They go out to crime scenes and you know, crimes that they're interested in. They fly there. They drive across the country. We have met a ton of them on this story, especially outside the laundry house. So I know you've got that coming up. Many of the people that we met out there.
Brian, you're doing such an amazing job. I don't know when you sleep, but you and Luis, you definitely deserve a meal on us. Thank you so much. And safe driving, both of you.
Thanks, Ashley.
Okay, Brian's going to pack up and continue on his journey. He's going to keep us updated all the way along. You know, like Brian just said, it really isn't that unusual for reporters like Brian to spend time visiting these important locations that are connected to a case. But It is unusual when other people show up and say, Brian, can I get a picture with you? This really caught our eye, this phenomenon in Northport. He said it, I'll say it, crime tourists. And you're going to meet two of them next. I have to tell you, right, the Gabby Petito case has touched so many people across the country, around the world. It's been a veritable circus on the front lawn of the laundry home, and that's been going on for nearly 6 weeks. We've seen people hammering in signs into the grass on their lawn. We've seen the protesters with the bullhorns just hollering at the house, and the humorous signs certainly making their point out there. Some of the folks out there had actually even traveled thousands of miles to be there. And our own Brian Enten spoke with four of those crime tourists.
We've been following the case since the very beginning, and it's been very intriguing to us. So we wanted to come and see all the action.
Yeah, to be able to see the space. Like, on TV, you can't tell how close this neighborhood is.
Which spots have you gone to so far in terms of in relation to the case?
Well, did we go to the Carlton Reserve first? We went to the main entrance. Nobody was there. And then we realized, no, it was the environmental center where everyone was, you know, staked out. Yeah. We were surprised at how big the area was. It took us like 20 minutes to get around to the other side where all you guys were at. So we've been there, we've been here to the house, the North Point Police Department, and the town over there. My son first told us about it, and then we just kept watching it. I probably started watching more than you did.
Yeah.
And then I feel like the thing that really captivated my interest was the whole
I was just really stressed this morning.
Video of when they were pulled over.
Yeah.
In the Tetons.
Yeah,
and the whole
Gabby probably caught your heart then, right? You saw what was going on.
I saw her. She reminds me of our daughter, blonde hair, same age and everything, and it was just like, wow, you know, this is really sad.
I know how she was feeling. And this is, I feel like I just had to be here. But I know she couldn't leave, I know she wanted to leave, and I know that she was afraid to say she wanted to leave. And it's classic narcissistic abuse, except he put in the physical with it. So this girl was completely helpless. She was stuck. She was completely stuck, and she knew it in her head that she was stuck. And it hurts my heart because I know how she was feeling. And I couldn't just not do anything.
I want to bring in two other people who made the trek to Northport, Florida to see all the different sites connected to this case, Brooke Ramlow and Shelby Simonson. Thank you both for joining me tonight. I find this so fascinating. I mean, we get sent on assignment to go to these places, and then you guys just decide this is intriguing and you know, worthy of your spare time. So, Shelby, I'll start with you. What was it that spoke to you so much that you and Brooke would join forces, you know, I believe in a social media group, and say, let's do this. Let's head down there and check it out.
I personally think that it was totally a God thing. I mean, it was just, for a lack of better term, it was the right timing. I was introduced to it on my birthday, and I was already behind. I'm from Florida. I'm from Titusville. But what really hit home for me was when I realized that Gabby was a month and 5 days older than my little sister. And I would say that's when it really became heartbreaking for me, and I became emotionally invested in this case.
So, Brooke, how did you and Shelby connect and make the plan to do this trip?
Well, actually, somebody introduced Shelby and I to each other on Twitter. And we started talking and messaging back and forth. And we both decided that we wanted to go down there. And we were just kind of tired of watching everything happen on TV and behind the screen, and really wanted to get out there and actually do something about it instead of just sitting here at home.
So when you got there, what was plan A? I mean, what did you decide to do first, Shelby? And what was your agenda?
Well, of course, I wanted to go and fix up my timeline and help with the manhunt. But unfortunately, on the way down there is when we found out that the remains were found. And once we got there, it was confirmed that it was Brian Laundry. So that kind of scratched our original plans. And unfortunately, it was just really bad timing. And we thought that it was inappropriate to go to some of the people to ask a lot of questions just for our own selfish, you know, uses for that timeline. But we really got to talk to a lot of really wonderful people and meet some awesome people down there and scrub up our timeline a little bit.
So then, Brooke, that is a very interesting time to arrive at the time that the remains are found. That's a lot of breaking news you were all of a sudden catapulted into. Did you go to the reserve? Did you see the activity at the reserve?
Yes. When we first got there, we went to the reserve. We walked around. It was really surreal to see everything firsthand. You know, it's crazy. You see everything on TV and we see you guys reporting. But to be able to actually walk up on the scene and see all the cameras set out right after they had done a conference confirming that it was Brian's remains that they found. And it was a really surreal experience to actually be there. So, yeah, we went to the reserve first and then we went to the laundry home afterwards.
And then I think I might have heard Brian Enten say at one point Cassie's home was on the list of places you want to go as well. I mean, what else was on the agenda, Shelby?
A lot of places. Of course, the Carlton, that was shut down. The laundry home, Cassie's home, a place that was brought out on a YouTube channel that said that there might have been a place where Brian had dumped some things when he first came home. And so just a lot of places we wanted to go to, and it just was a horrible timing on our part.
So I'm super interested in the connection that you have to the story, Brooke, and all the folks that, you know, you've been talking with on Twitter as well. I mean, this is a real community, and I dare say that they're really smart. I mean, they notice a lot of things that are, you know, might get passed over on first look, and nope. The community is right in there to highlight them, bring them forward, and get them out into the open. Do you both feel a lot closer to this story? Do you feel almost a different satisfaction now that you've made that trip and you've actually been to those places and it's not just coming through your TV screen or the screen of your phone? And I'll let you answer first, Brooke.
Well, I definitely feel more of a connection with the area. Actually being there instead of watching it on TV, you get a completely different feel for everything that's happening. Of course, we were not expecting the results to be the way that they ended up, but I'm still really grateful that we went. We did meet some amazing people, and I'm just so blessed to have the opportunity and to have met all this community that we have on Twitter. It's been really amazing.
And Shelby, how about you? Do you think you have a planned trip to Moab or Salt Lake or Grand Teton after this?
I'd love to, but we are actually starting on the Summer Wells timeline right now, and we will be moving into Tiffany Foster as soon as I finish with the Summer Wells timeline. So for this moment in time, we're pausing on this and starting our, you know, repertoire of the bigger picture.
So it's on to the next crime. Well, maybe we can touch base with you on the next one as well and see, how that goes for you. Brooke Ramlow, Shelby Simonson, thank you so much for joining us on this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley. Thanks
for having us.
Okay, ladies. It's really interesting. I'm going to switch gears because the person who wrangles guns on a movie set, that's called the armorer. And the armorer who was on the set when Alec Baldwin accidentally killed a member of the crew was a 24-year-old woman who had done that job exactly once before on a Nicolas Cage movie. So how did that film go last summer? A Hollywood veteran who worked on the set with her says, not good. Not good at all. And he is live with me next. They gathered in the New Mexico dust today, cameras rolling, cables and crew members at the ready, only this was no film shoot. It was a press conference. And standing before the mics were both the sheriff and the DA of Santa Fe County with some new details on the fatal shooting on the Alec Baldwin movie set.
On Thursday, October 21st, 2001, at 1:48 p.m., we were dispatched to Bonanza Creek Ranch in reference to a 911 call advising that two people had been shot on a movie set. The first deputy arrived at 2 o'clock p.m. and EMS arrived at 2:01 p.m. It was later determined that Helena Hutchins, the director of cinematography, and Joel Souza, the director, had been shot while rehearsing a scene on the movie Rust.
They will not say yet who, if anyone, might just be paying a criminal price for this colossal disaster. But all eyes are on Alec Baldwin, an actor and a producer on the film who fired the deadly shot, and Dave Halls, the assistant director who handed him the gun. But then there's the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez Reed. According to an affidavit, she told authorities, quote, no live ammo is ever kept on the set. And we now know that is just simply not true. Because a real bullet went through cinematographer Helena Hutchins, killing her, and then continued in to lodge itself in the shoulder of the man standing behind her, the director, Joel Souza. We also know that real bullets were more than likely recovered on the set by sheriff's deputies in their investigation. And I say more than likely because they just, you know, they have to get them proven, but a sheriff's deputy knows when you have a live round in your hand. Rust was only the second gig as armorer for the 24-year-old, and by many accounts, there were major problems on her previous movie set, a Nicolas Cage Western called The Old Way. The key grip on a film set is responsible for getting the cameras and the gear into place and also has a hand in the safety. And the key grip on this Nicolas Cage film said that Hannah was a rookie who put the cast in danger on multiple occasions. Stu Brumbaugh is that key grip who worked with Hannah, and he is live with me now. Stu, thank you so much for being on the program. What were some of the specific incidents that happened with Hannah on the set of that Nicolas Cage movie?
Hi, Ashley. You know, I guess I first want to start out by saying my purpose for being here is not to vilify anybody. You know, we had a great crew on our film set. We had a great production team. Everybody was a pleasure to work with, and I would certainly take that job again any day of the week. You know, there were just some red flags with Hannah. You know, she's a young woman starting out in her career, and you know, being a gun individual myself, you know, there's just this this kind of known view of the way that you handle firearms on a set and, you know, anywhere else that you carry firearms. And it just kind of sparked my attention right away. And then a few incidents happened that, you know, really got me upset and, you know, made me want to get her removed from the set because of it.
So regarding those incidents, you know, I think I've seen an account where the allegation is she's walked onto the set with live rounds unannounced to anyone. To me, that's astounding because to me, live rounds in non-movie speak is bullets as opposed to live rounds in movie speak, right, which is blanks. That yeah. She had them tucked. There's she had the pistols there. Tucked under her arm, right? Like under her armpits facing backwards where the barrel of the gun would be facing the people behind you. To me, that is, I don't know how anyone who has ever heard of any gun safety would ever do that. That she's allowed firearms to be aimed at people. Again, I'm not in your business, but I know that that is rule number one that you can't break, and that she fired off rounds unannounced. Yes, blanks, but that can be, you know, catastrophic on a Western. I mean, horses can be spooked, people can freak out, right?
Sure, absolutely. You know, the like I said before, I mean, she's 24 years old. She's getting her career started. She's very eager, you know, and what this really boils down to is just not having enough help on the set, you know, and I don't think that somebody being killed is any sort of, you know, a free pass just because you're young. Obviously, there's major things happening on these movie sets that need to change significantly. You know, there's a protocol that we do on these movie sets that they were broken on numerous occasions. You know, I could understand, you know, her being young and there's one mistake that's happened and we can kind of let that slide. But when it continues, obviously we got some problems there.
So I know that a producer and a prop master defended her and said they didn't know any of these things, but there's widespread reporting of Nicolas Cage, who was the actor on your movie, really like getting angry because She fired off a blank round right next to him, and he, you know, said he couldn't hear it. It was terrifying. And he said, you know, you're supposed to announce these things. But that to me just sounds, you know, again, I'm not an armorer, but I know I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, you know, she had it was her first movie. So knowing these protocols of what to do on set, it was obviously they didn't happen a lot of times. I mean, there were announcements made occasionally, but there were two incidents that, you know, it certainly didn't happen. And, you know, people didn't have ear protection in, and, you know, people just weren't prepared to have a gun go off on set.
I will say I spoke to a prominent movie director today who didn't want to be named, but they said that the way it always works, and this person had been on plenty of sets with guns, you know, the first AD will shine a light through the barrel, and they will show the actor right. that, and the director will see that as yeah. well. And I think had any of this been done, this group right here wouldn't be making the news for the reason they're making the news right now. Hey, Stu Brumbaugh, thanks very much for being here. Really appreciate it. And my heart goes out to your community, because I know you're all going through a lot with regard to this.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Coming up, some brand new disclosures, brand new warrants, and a bombshell admission in the all-too-preventable tragedy on that set. Straight ahead, the sheriff speaks, the DA speaks, and the documents? Wow, those speak for themselves. You're going to see them next. Welcome back. We really learned a lot today from the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Department. First, when the sheriff and the DA stood in front of the reporters for the first time since the tragedy happened. And then later in a search warrant for a prop truck that was used to store guns. There was a safe in the truck and the guns used to be in the safe. We know that detectives in two earlier searches seized 600 pieces of evidence, including three guns and 500 rounds of ammo. Just think about that. That ammo cache, by the way, is a mix of blanks and dummy rounds and what is believed to be live rounds containing actual bullets. We also know a very real slug was pulled from the shoulder of the director, Joel Souza, right after it passed through the torso of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. How that slug ended up in a movie prop gun is really the only question that matters right now. And we now have some pretty sobering clues. Joining me to sort them all out is our friend Jim Murray, who is the chief correspondent on Inside Edition and a lawyer, I might add. And I'm also joined by Charlotte Triggs, managing editor of People.com. The brand new issue hits newsstands everywhere on Friday. Welcome to you both. Jim Murray, I'm going to start with you. As I was reading through this affidavit, the search warrant, I was just sort of struck by the sheer volume of ammo. Now, I get it. On a Western, there probably should be a lot of blanks, right? And I would think maybe 500 wouldn't be weird. But I would think it would be really weird to find even one casing that had a bullet on the tip instead of a pinched off zero, no projectile at all. I'd love to just get your thoughts, because I know you've covered Hollywood for a long time.
I mean, I remember covering the 1993 case with Brandon Lee, and since then there have been no notable cases at all of any tragedies on the set regarding guns. And there should be this many bullets on or near the set. None, specifically because of this, because it's so dangerous. These are, they're referred to as prop guns, but nationally, this was a real gun. It shot blanks, but as we saw here in this case, it also shot real bullets. And property masters and armorers know that real bullets have no place at all on a movie set.
So I'm going to pull on that thread a little bit, Jim, especially since you're a lawyer. When the armorer, 24 years old, was asked a question, because they all voluntarily gave statements right away. I don't think they're used to the idea of I better get a lawyer. I think they were so traumatized by what that had happened. They wanted to help in any way they could. But when Hannah Gutierrez Reed was asked, I'm going to read this actually from the warrant. It said, when affiant asked about live ammo on the set, Hannah responded, quote, no live ammo is ever kept on the set. So I don't know. I mean, maybe this is good for her. It sounds to me like it's crazy, because clearly there was a live round that killed a person and injured another. And now they're saying there are a few other live rounds that they can't say for sure, because that would be for the FBO lab in Quantico to determine. But, you know, they're sheriff's deputies. They know a bullet when they see one. So do you think it's her defense, Jim, that she said, look, as far as I'm concerned, I'm the armorer, and I had no live ammo on that set. If somebody else sneaked something in, then I don't know about it, and they should be punished.
There's a problem here, and that is the armorer, the property master, maintains a chain of custody of this weapon. They are responsible not only for storing the weapon, but also storing the ammo. And more importantly, before handing that gun to anyone on the set, they need to check the gun. You were talking earlier about looking with a flashlight. I talked to a property master the other day, showed me this very same type of gun. This barrel doesn't come out. It doesn't pivot. So you have to open a hatch and then spin the barrel. And you use a flashlight and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to make sure there's nothing in those barrels, nothing in the chambers, nothing anywhere that could be a projectile. That is the responsibility of this woman, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. And clearly this wasn't done, and clearly there was a live round on the set. We know a live round killed one woman and injured another person.
Yeah, and I'm just to tag onto that, and Charlotte, I want to get you on this. The detective who did the interview with the AD, Assistant Director Dave Halls, this is what they said Dave told them, and I'm going to quote, "I check the barrel for obstructions. Most of the time there's no live fire. She, Hannah, opens the hatch, spins the drum, and I say cold gun on set. David advised that when Hannah showed him the firearm before continuing rehearsal, he could only remember seeing 3 rounds. He advised that he should have checked all of them, but didn't, and couldn't recall if she spun the drum." Normally, I would say we didn't even need those facts to have a cover of People magazine, Charlotte, but that is your cover, and I know that you have more details.
Well, you know, actually, in subsequent statements, he said that there were 4 dummy rounds in there, aka blanks, and one that appeared to not have a hole in it, which seems to indicate what some people have thought might be the case, that there could have been a blank, the casing from a blank that remained stuck in the barrel, and the projectile turned it into basically a live bullet. I mean, that's what the reality of all of this is that even if there are blanks, you still have to check that the casings come out, because that can be basically activated by any effects. And so that's part of the job. It's not just to put the blanks in. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've had deaths from blanks before. Okay, hold your thoughts for a second, guys, because when we come back, you know, gosh, I think it's, what, 28 years ago, but Brandon Lee was killed on a set, and his fiancée is coming out, and she has some choice words for the industry. We're going to dig into that next, back after this. We're following the latest news out of New Mexico. Have you all seen this sort of remarkable series of pictures? I just got a real eerie feeling when I saw them. They're photos from inside the actual church, the inside part of the movie set. And look on there, you can see up close, there's Alec Baldwin in the center with someone else in period costume. Here's the empty church. As you can see it a little bit more daylight, but this is how small the inside of that church was. The reason I ask that, Charlotte Triggs, is because today the sheriff said there were like 90 to 100 people on this set, but very few inside. And I wanted to sort of drill down on that with you and your reporting regarding how many people we think actually might be at the center of this investigation that could fit. I mean, you can see right there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there's like 6 or 7, maybe 8 people. But not 90, that's for sure.
Well, if you want a little context as to the safety issues that they were experiencing on this production, apparently the director had to actually tell people to leave the set because he wasn't sure that the second floor of the church would actually hold their weight. He was afraid that it might collapse. So that right there tells you that a little bit of something that was, you know, maybe a red flag in terms of safety, which is something we've heard from a lot of on-set production sources. But yeah, there are probably about maybe 6 or 7 people that were even able to fit in that room. And it really all comes down to the armorer, Alec Baldwin, and the assistant director, who's the one who handed the gun from the armorer to Alec. Yeah. And those are kind of the key people who, you know, were in possession of the gun.
Yeah. So I'm going to read this statement from Eliza Hutton. She's Brandon Lee's fiance. He was killed back in 1993 on a set with a gun. She said, 28 years ago, I was shattered by the shock and grief of losing the love of my life, Brandon Lee, so senselessly. My heart aches again now for Helena Hutchins' husband and son, and for all those left in the wake of this avoidable tragedy. I urge those in positions to make change, to consider alternatives to real guns on sets. Jim Murray, I want you to sort of take that away. You're in the land where movies are everything. They are the business of Hollywood. What is happening in Hollywood right now with regard to all of that, with regard to guns on sets and safety on sets and budget cutting?
Well, look, there's so much clamor for content. I think that there's a great deal of pressure to bring budgets down. And when you do that, many people will inevitably cut corners. And that may be what happened here. We know that they hired a 24-year-old armorer. She was probably much less expensive than somebody else would have been. There is a pressure to cut costs. But when you talk about guns on set, you know, the TV show The Rookie has said they will use no live ammo whatsoever from here forward. Many actors like to use blanks because there's a recoil, there's smoke,
sure.
It's more
yeah.
realistic.
Yeah.
But you do not ever, ever, ever have live ammo. And this was, as the fiancé said, an avoidable tragedy.
It was indeed. Jim Murray, thank you. Charlotte Triggs, thank you. People Magazine is on the store shelves on Friday. Appreciate both of your insight. And thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight. I do want to remind you that our Brian Enten is traveling, taking the road that Gabby Petito and Brian Laundrie took on their journey. He will be filing for a special report later this week, and we'll see you on Banfield tomorrow.